But no, much appreciation to everyone who threw their labor in. I was surprised at the number of folks that showed up. Typically for a work day, at a Baptist church, you do get a good strong amount of folks turning up. But again, I was surprised. I was very pleasantly happy at the number. A little concerned about some of you. I won't tell you who, but a little concerned, but stuff got done all the same. And I appreciate it. What was it? It was Brother Mike said that. It was, hey, we may not all be able to do what we used to be able to do, but together we got it done. Now that doesn't mean me, because I'm still young and I could do stuff. Not right, according to Brother Charlie, but I... No, I had a good time yesterday. I know. 2 Samuel 15, verse 1 says, "And it came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, that Absalom called unto him and said, 'Of what city art thou?' And he said, 'Thy servant is one of the tribes of Israel.' And Absalom said unto him, 'See, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee.' Absalom said, 'Moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which hath any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice.'" Now, what we're seeing here is Absalom is, of course, angry at his father. There was a lot of turmoil that ended up in the family, a lot of issues that stemmed from David's sin. And what Absalom was doing here was he'd go down to the gate, and in many ways a king would act as a great judge over the people. So if there was any disputes or any issues, you'd come forward, and either the king would deputize somebody to handle the issues and dispense justice, or he would handle those things himself. So what Absalom would do is he would go down to the gate, and as people would come in, hey, where are you from? Well, I tell you what, I understand you've got a good grievance there, but you know what, the king's not hearing anybody and he doesn't have anybody to hear anybody. Man, I wish I was a judge in this land. I wish I was in charge of this land. I would be able to handle all of this stuff, but right now there's nothing there. And his attempt here was to get people disquieted, to get people upset about David. He wanted the charge. He wanted to be in control. He wanted that throne. And in many cases, we see that today where everybody wants to be a king or a queen, regardless of how little they've been prepared, how little they understand, or how little use they actually are in their own lives. They have this idea of rulership, of being in charge, being able to say one thing or the other, and it being perfectly okay. And that's not the way we're made. We're not made to naturally know what's going on. It takes understanding and learning and preparation and training for people to take positions. God anointed David himself to be the leader of this nation. Absalom, by use of his own anger and his own pride, took position. What we need is we need to stand against the giant of pride. We need to dare to be meek. David was a great warrior and a king, a mighty leader of mighty men. As a boy, he had slain Goliath, but one of the ways he showed his greatest strength was in the meekness and sacrificial love that he showed toward Absalom, who did all these things against him. While Absalom sought power, David controlled the situation. David showed love and deference to his son. At any given time, David could have had his son killed, even when it came down to battle between his forces and the forces that Absalom had amassed. He still gave the command to not kill Absalom, and he punished the man who would go on to kill Absalom while he was stuck. So we see this love, and not just in theory, not just in word, but love in practice. What we are seeing here is the beginnings of a real crisis. David had been the authority in the land, but as is always the case where God has established a plan, Satan will come up with a counter plan. This is especially true in a situation which God is truly blessing. You know, in many ways, God blessed David's reign. He set it up. He established it. He blessed victory after victory into it. And of course, here will come the devil or some loudmouth person to try to upend that. David had won many great victories. He was a man after God's own heart, and now Satan was trying to undermine what God had ordained. In our lives, when it appears that things are going smoothly, and though we may feel strong spiritually, we can count on the fact that Satan is on the prowl, and we cannot afford to let down our guard. 1 Peter 5, verse 8 says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. Whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world." You know, there are times of great battles within a church, times of great battles within a family, or even on a personal level, where we are struggling with things. And it's often when there aren't problems, we become complacent. When does a soldier reload their weapon? During the downtime, right? You make sure everything's all laid out. When does a warrior in the Roman army, they were always told to sharpen their swords as they rested. Make sure that everything was clean, everything was good, everything was ready to go. I had a friend who just recently went camping, and he bemoaned the fact that every time he goes camping, he forgets that his tent's broken. Now, instead of taking the tent home and fixing the tent, what does he do? He does what probably a lot of people do. All right, well, I'll fix that before I go next time. And just enough time has gone between camping sessions, they completely forgot that they didn't fix the tent. So they'll go there, and there'll be a leaning side or a leak somewhere. What do you fix those things? The moment you see those problems. And you know what? You take those downtimes where there isn't contestations or problems, and you prepare for the next coming ones. Not with anxiety or worry or fear, but prepare yourself. You know what? I haven't had to pray for a problem that we've had for a while. So you know what? I'm going to pray extra in thanks. I'm going to pray extra in that the Lord would prepare me and stabilize me for the next battle that's coming. Right, just as he has cleared away the last battle, I know that he'll clear away the next one, so I don't have to worry about it, I don't have to panic, but what I do have to do is I have to prepare for what's coming next. Right? When we give advice to young people as they're first getting out on their own, you know, Brother Charlie said, well, you know, if you don't have children, don't rush, get married first. You know, in the apartment industry, I tell people that all the time. They'll come in, and every now and then people would ask. Actually, it surprised you how often people ask if they should do what they're supposed to be doing to the person who's actually selling them the thing that they're about to do. And I'll tell them, well, listen, you guys aren't married. And you know, I'm a very biblical person, so I have a belief on this. But if you don't, well, we're not biblical, we don't believe in that stuff. All right, well, let me put it this way. You're entering into a contract with somebody that you're not legally bound to. All right, you split, there'll be huge problems. Or how about this one? I'll get people that are 18 years old. They want to get out of parents' house. All they know is they got to get out of their parents' house. Got to get out, got to get out, got to get out. They've got $0 to their name. They're going to go get an apartment. And I'll tell them all the time, I go, listen, what you need to do at your age is you'll figure out whatever controversy is going on at the house, put some money in the bank. Right? If you can go 18, 19, 20 years old and you've got money in the bank, that's a good start. That's where you need to be. Don't play games. Don't try to spend all the money you've got. I knew one person barely out of high school, had a part-time job making whatever minimum wage was at the time at McDonald's. And they went out and they bought a car that would have taken them 10 or 12 years probably at that rate to pay off. Why would you do that? You know, but my favorite car of all time, of all the cars I've ever owned, was that 1986 Suburban. I mowed lawns to get it. I did tutoring to get it. I whatever I could do to get some money to pay for that car, I did. Love that car. Absolutely loved it. Was it a Ferrari? No, but did I need a Ferrari? Absolutely not. Who in their right mind would give a 17-year-old kid a Ferrari? Right, what a mess that would be. Right? Save money. Put something away. Now, is it wrong for kids to have nice things? Absolutely not. But the nicest things that a kid can have is the knowledge of how to grow and do things, how to save, how to invest, how to make their money-making decisions, what to do for the future. Those are the tools they really need. So if they have those things and they have those tools, well, praise the Lord. Good job, Mom and Dad. If not, stop everything and let's handle the real issue at hand. Right, we can't just dive into crisis after crisis. So what do we tell these people? Prepare for the oncoming trouble. Right. Well, how much money should I have in the bank before I go rent an apartment? Now, honestly, I'd much rather you buy a house. I would. From somebody who came from the apartment industry, you're literally just opening window and throwing money out the window as you rent. But what I would tell you, if you have to rent an apartment, what I would have you to do is have at least 4 months worth of rent in your bank account before you even go. That's what I tell people. You lose your job, that gives you 2 whole months and some change to get your life right, to get another one, to get things figured out, get your feet up underneath you. Oh, well, I don't like that. So they dive into a crisis. No, prepare for a crisis. Prepare for a trouble. As a church, we've got special money set aside just in case something catastrophic were to happen. We'd still be able to keep the lights on for a certain period of time. We plan for a crisis. We don't panic for it. We don't worry. We don't get anxiety. But we prepare. Now, here David is again in another one of those crises. His son is against him. He's trying to upend the throne. What we need to do is we need to be careful because the devil's working. While we're waiting, while we're relaxing, the devil's working. Verse 9 of 1 Peter chapter 5 says, "Whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world." Calmness and contentment can turn into crisis and chaos in a heartbeat with no warning at all. We must stay close to God at all times. Now, Absalom, as we read down through to verse 12, Absalom challenged David. We see that he tried to take his place himself and get himself into a position that he had no right to take. His approach might have seemed innocent to the average naive observer. He said that he was there to solve problems. Verse 2 through 4, he made it seem like he was the solution to a problem. But there was no problem. He invented the problem, much like what we see in the news today. Did you see the vice president got herself into a little bit of trouble this last week? Or was it Saturday? Got herself into a little bit of trouble? She had one of those Juneteenth celebrations. Now, June 19th is the day of emancipation. Now, we can't call it emancipation, and I'm terrified as to the reason why we can't just say the word emancipation, but call it Juneteenth. They'd got pictures of her celebration, and in the pictures of her celebration, she had Elizabeth Warren, she had a bunch of staffers, a bunch of people that we would know from the news, all in attendance, all of them Caucasian. Now, don't get me wrong, that there were people of different ethnicities, but they were the ones serving the food. I kind of looked at that, and I go, if anything summed up my definition of the word northern racism, that's it. We're celebrating the emancipation of an entire group of people, and the way we're celebrating that is with all of my white friends. And who are we going to have as the servants? Well, that seemed wrong to me. Why are all of the people serving the food of a particular ethnic background? And this is how we're celebrating that we no longer treat people that way. I was just very upset by that. It got to me because I've always believed there's two different kinds of racism. There's the southern racism where they'll burn a cross in your front yard and kill the individual and hate the entire race. But every now and then you get them that they're kind to their neighbor who is black. And then you got the northern racism where we'll say that we're not racist and we'll say that we love everybody of every different ethnicity. But at the same time, we won't let them at the table, but we're perfectly okay with them serving. Yeah, it's kind of a facade of equality, but it's not real equality. There's no real love, as Jesus Christ teaches, where I love my neighbor because they're my neighbor. That's how Jesus Christ teaches it. I love you because you're my neighbor, as opposed to the weirdness that we see with Kamala Harris. But there was no problem. And in their case, we're celebrating a problem. Well, there is a problem, and you're kind of making it worse. In Absalom's case, he created the problem, and he made it worse, right? Well, there's no solution that my dad has. I wish I was in charge. Man, if I were the king, I would fix this. I grew up, and every now and then you'd hear that there was that one guy that we had at our church for a little while. If I was the pastor, I'd X, Y, or Z. If I was the pastor, I'd do this or that. Well, okay, well, did you say anything to the pastor? Well, no. Well, then what's the purpose of all your complaining and all your whining? If you've got wisdom that you're not willing to share, the only reason I could think of you doing that is because you yourself want the position. And that's counterintuitive. That's counterproductive. If you've got wisdom, share it. You know, we'll be in that where we'll be doing something. One of y'all will come up to me and say, "Hey, Pastor, have you thought about doing this? Have you thought about doing that?" And you know what? Maybe I haven't. Thank you for sharing. And we'll go about and we'll do something. was her brother Bill. He's not here. He'll probably be here a little bit later. He came over. We were doing the work day, and he goes, "You know what? I want to fix those handrails." Just of his own volition, "I want to fix the handrails." So he came to me. "Have you ever thought about fixing the handrails?" I said, "You know what, brother? I've never thought about the handrails." You know what he did? He came on in here. Brother Wade was in here. I think I beat you guys in here, though. I was like, "Yeah, let's go take a look at those handrails." Yep. Boom. I said, there was no, "Well, if I were the pastor, I'd make sure all of this." No, hey, I have an idea. And we all kind of look at it. "Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go." That's the way that works. Absalom wasn't going to his dad and saying, "Hey, Dad, you need more representatives, more judges in the land to fix this problem." He had no heart to fix the problem. His heart was to be the solution. His heart was to be the one in that place. Because, again, I think there was a lot of resentment from Absalom left over from that situation with his sister. We also see that Absalom does his best to draw the people to himself, right? In any conflict, there's always that person who wants to pull themselves up through that conflict. "Look at me. See what I can do. See what I'm capable of." That's not the real solution. I like people who look at a problem and say, "What we need to do is this, this, or that," right? The kind of person who wants to push the conflict and make themselves look better is the person who says, "Well, you know, brother so-and-so, they've got this fault and that fault and this fault," instead of us actually putting some solutions on the table and getting it done. And I've absolutely hated that among how a lot of people get together in churches, is they don't quite want to solve the problem. They want to be lifted up. They want to be made the center of the solution so that everyone would worship them. I don't see that here. Please don't take that personally. We're just talking academically, right? We don't want that. We don't want a case of the situation where it's not a matter of focusing on the problem. We're focusing on the people of the problem. And guess what? People, most often, we are the problem. If there were no people, there'd be no sin on this earth. If there were no people, there'd be no problems on this earth. Wherever you got us, there will be trouble, right? It makes no point in us sitting there pointing fingers and being angry at each other. What matters is that we look at what's really going on and fixing it. It should always cause great concern when someone who should be serving the person placed over him and said usurps loyalty from others. This can happen in the workplace or in the church. An employee may seek to garner support from coworkers at the expense of his employer. A deacon, a Sunday school teacher, a layman may imply that the pastor is too busy to deal with a problem or is somehow lacking in leadership ability. But the fact of the matter is, you can't replace what the Lord put there. You can help. You can put it. You can put in the effort. You can give counsel and wisdom. But at the same time, it's not ours to take over. I was working in a place one time, and a guy was fighting the boss and fighting the boss and fighting the boss. And after a while, he just tried to get everybody on his side. "Well, listen, you know, I told the boss this and I told the boss that. The boss don't listen. The boss don't care. The boss don't see what we're going through." So in his intention is he wanted to replace the boss. But there was a problem. The boss was the owner. Boss was the owner. You can't unseat the owner. You can maybe buy the business from him. You can't unseat the owner. So I just kind of laughed. He goes, "What are you laughing at?" I go, "I'm laughing at you spinning your wheels. Right? You're whining and you're complaining and you're making every day I got to come to work miserable because I got to deal with you. Listen, we got policies, we got procedures. Let's abide by them. There's problems. Let's use what we've got to fix those problems." I go, "But you just running your jaw nonstop is driving me crazy." Just kind of laugh at the guy. We need to look at what God ordained, what is placed there, and solve just problems. Just solve the problems. Let's not pick. I came home yesterday, it was a couple days ago, after looking at our bills that were coming up. You know what I noticed? It is that time of year. AC bill, or the electrical bill, a consumer's bill. It went up. And I came home, and guess what I found? The breezeway door. For those of you that have been over at the house, our breezeway door was open. Now, there are two reasons why that breezeway door is open. One, the kids like to run in and out. Once that breezeway door is closed, you can't get in and out. So you know what? Every now and then, they'll leave it just cracked so. And then sometimes, depending on who it is and what kind of mood they're in, they've just left it wide open. They're like, "Outside!" Because they're kids. That's what they do. "We're going to go outside." They don't think about closing the door. The other one is they'll leave it just cracked and the cats will get at it because they love that breezeway. They love being out there, laying out in the sun. So I come home after looking at that bill going, "Whoo! We need to start fixing some things. We need to do this. We need to do that. I came home. That door was wide open. air conditioner was running, blasted me in the face as I walked across that threshold. What kind of mood do you think I was in? Daddy was not happy. So I closed the door and got the family together, as you do. And I say, listen, I go, I've said on multiple occasions, we need to keep that door closed. That door needs to be closed. Here are some of the arguments that I got back out of it. Well, the cats opened it. Sitting, I'm like, all right, well, let's get a cat. Where's the cat? Get the cat. No opposable thumbs on the cats. Just had to be sure before I made my argument. Those cats did not open that door. They nudge it when it's cracked? Yeah. But my definition of closed is closed. Their definition of closed is, well, you can barely see the daylight. You know? Like, the cats aren't opening it. You're leaving it unlatched. I could sit there and I could punish every single last one of them. I could insult every single last one of them. I could beat all of them down. But ultimately, what's the solution? Close the door. The end. Close the door. Right? Let's make sure we don't have windows open. Let's look at how we're running the thermostat. Let's look at the real problem. Instead of me letting out all my frustration, instead of me picking on the kids, instead of one of the kids going, well, I always close the door. It's these ones over here. We don't need any of that. We don't need any of this weirdness. All we need is to close the door, monitor the thermostat, let's pay attention. Right? Attention to detail. We'll get through this as a family. That's what it comes down to. Too often we let problems get oversized because we look at the wrong things. We look at the people in the problem. Now, ultimately, the people are the problem, and if we could just stop doing some of the things we're doing, that'll be it. But we need to focus on the things we need to stop, focus on the things we need to start, and not try to sit there and develop grudges and backbiting and bigger egos based on who messed what up. Let's just fix what's there. Proverbs 6 verse 16 says, these six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him. Verse 19, just kind of cutting this in half a little bit. He that soweth discord among the brethren. Those people who just love to stir up trouble. Put your spoon down. Stop stirring up trouble. Right? Let's fix the problem. All right? Is there a fly in the soup? Get the fly out. Personally, I say dump the whole soup, but hey, good protein in there. I don't know. But so solve the problems instead of creating more. And that's what Absalom wanted. Absalom wanted problems. He wanted problems because it served his motivations. And David himself, he was forced into a dilemma here. He loved his son, but at the same time, God gave him responsibility over the kingdom. Now, he could step aside and defer to his son, let him have the kingdom, dishonor God, and create trouble. Or he could kill his son, right, break his own heart, and still remain being the king. This is difficult. Now, David, I think he picked the wise choice, where all I've got to do is put down this enemy, save Absalom alive, and try to fix the issues in my family. And this is the kind of middle-of-the-road thinking we need to have when it comes down to dilemmas. Not radical, one side to the other. But what is it that God wants me to do? God wants me to be the king. And part of the job of the king is to lay down usurpers and to put them away and to stop trouble, stop rebellion in the family here, stop rebellion in the kingdom. Wherever we are called to be peacekeepers of one sort or the other. How is it that we can honor God and at the same time not completely obliterate our responsibilities to him? Because no matter what, if David were to have given up the kingdom, he would have disappointed God. And I do believe that if David would have reacted in anger and murdered his son, I think that would have been wrong. I think what David did here was appropriate. How can I play the part of the father and at the same time play the part of the king? How do I withhold all of my obligations at once? And of course, this was the dilemma that was thrust on him. We see David and his men, as well as the priests and the ark, leaving the city. Although his son Absalom was obviously in the wrong and was in fact committing outright treason, David did not choose to have him hung high from the rafters. And in many cases, I think if you look at it, there was not a lot of strategic ability for him to do that. Absalom had completely twisted much of the kingdom's heart to where even if David had put down Absalom's forces, he would have dealt with rebellion after rebellion after rebellion. It would have been bad. It would have been much like if the dictator would have won. There had to have been a more subtle or better solution to this. It's interesting that those who knew David best, his family and his servants, even at the moment of crisis, remained loyal to the biblical leadership in their life. It certainly did not look as if David was going to be on the winning side, but they knew the wisdom in following the man God had chosen. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in the sermon later on this morning. But ultimately, if you make decisions based on sound wisdom, people are more willing to listen to you. They are. At least I know that I am. If I'm looking at somebody who's doing something for the first time, it always makes me nervous. Right? I'll look at that and go, all right, let's watch to see how they do. Now, I'm not, I don't have a superior kind of mentality. If I'm seeing something and I'm watching it, I go, all right, let me see how it goes. I'm not going to be immediately negative or dissuade them or stop them. Everybody has a beginning. So I'll watch and see what's going on. But given the choice to rely on somebody with more experience and knowledge, that's who I would go with. It was kind of fun. I'm watching the big old tractor. And you know what I wanted to do yesterday? I wanted to drive the tractor. I did. You ever just look at a big old piece of equipment going, man, I want to get on that thing. I want to see what that'll do. I even had this thought where I was going to ask you to maybe hoist me up to the roof because I wanted to check out some of the roof. Like, let me just grab a hold of that big old claw thing. I'd have fallen, by the way. Don't. Also, if you would have let me into that thing, I would have crashed that thing. I would have caused so much trouble. Why? Because I, you know, as adult as I am, if I don't have any idea what I'm doing, I'm going to make a mess. You know, I'm not Caspian who's going to sit there and push all the buttons. But at the same time, with no knowledge and no experience, I'm the worst person you want to have trying to rip trees up. I'd have taken the whole shed down is what I would have done. Trying to get one tree, I'd have taken the whole shed down, probably a couple cars. And I would have had to apologize this morning for that. You know, you're careful of certain things. But I watched Brother Dwayne driving that thing around. I felt a certain level of confidence. I go, all right, this man knows how to rip a tree out of the ground with his giant tractor thing. That looked pretty cool. You know, I appreciate certain things like that. You know what? Sound wisdom creates a reliance. Much of the people who loved David still listened and followed David. Why? Because they saw how he made his decisions. And while we could point to one glaring thing that he did wrong, much of David's life was spent relying on what God had to say. And when you see a life, whether it's a man or a woman, who purposely make their decisions and their lifestyle choices after what God has to say, you're going to want to rely on them. You're going to want them in your corner because they have an order and a method to what they're doing, as opposed to the haphazard way many of us fall into when we're not paying attention or we lack experience. Right? We trusted that in David's dilemma, he fell back on what he had always fallen back on. He trusted in what he had always trusted in. We'll cover the rest of this next week. I do want to say this. We are nearing the end of our study on David. We're going to be diving into more Bible doctrine. And what I have is a set of lessons that we would do with maybe a new Christian. Now, I know most of you aren't new Christians. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to make it a little bit more interesting for you. And the goal is that if we do have a new member, somebody who's just newly saved, we could go through that with them. And what I'll do is I want to teach you guys first, and I want to teach you a little bit deeper in the theology than what's being given. But at the same time, I also want to teach you how to teach it when you teach it, because we're going to get new people. I want to be able to hand this lesson over to you and say, all right, you're starting this discipleship course with this person down here with maybe two or three new people, if the Lord blesses us like that. And here you go. Now you know what to teach, how to teach it, and you've got that in your back pocket to use. So that's what we're going to be diving into next. Probably a couple more lessons, maybe another month or a month and a half, and we'll be done with this. But I hope you're looking forward to that. I know I am. Let's pray. Heavenly Father,